Good morning and welcome to our session on defining and measuring food and nutrition security in vulnerable communities. Our objectives this morning are to give you some of the background, the academic foundations of food and nutrition security. And we have some very highly qualified speakers to present to you. But first, I would like to give you a few minutes, 5 minutes, background on some of the basic concepts of food and nutrition security. But before I get started, please mute your cell phones or turn them off. And I want to assure you that the speakers will be held to 15 minutes once they begin. Okay, so last night and throughout your background understanding of the program today, the definition of food insecurity is when all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access and use of sufficient, safe, and nutritious food, which meets their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. Now, that is quite a mouthful of a definition that presents many important concepts. But you have to understand that the right, the human right, as defined within the United Nations systems for us, all of us on this earth, is the right to adequate food and the right to health are universal human rights. And our first speaker in this session will address this as well as some of the training aspects related to human rights. What are some of the key driving forces for food and nutrition security? Just encapsulating these in a few key words, peace and social stability within a country, within a community, food and water access, income and or livelihoods as defined within the culture, and education as well as defined within the culture. But the four key pillars of food are that it is available, accessible, acceptable within the culture, and sustainable. So keep those concepts in mind as we continue through the sessions this morning. Some of the consequences of unsustainable food and nutrition security, they may be obvious to most of us here. Hunger being number one, and following that, poor health resulting from poor nutrition. Lack of educational and social attainment, especially as defined within the culture. And ultimately resulting in conflicts for food and or water and or land access to supply this food and nutrition security. So as I say, this is an outline of key concepts, each of which could be addressed in an hour or more lecture. Measuring food and nutrition security has been going on for decades. And there are many interesting measures that are either qualitative and or quantitative, and these can be conducted at the individual level, at the household level, the community, regional, national, and international level. Our third speaker this morning is an international specialist in measuring household food security, and will tell us how these measures can be translated then to the community, regional, national, and international levels. Some of the measurement tools that exist are quite profound. Within the Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, we recognize the Food Insecurity and Vulnerability Information Mapping Systems, that are derived from national food balance sheets that are returned to the FAO annually. There's the household food security interviews that emphasize hunger, income, and or livelihood, and livelihood as it can be defined within the culture. Again, it may not be necessarily money. The third measurement tool that is coming to the fore in this day and age is dietary biodiversity and quality. And Dr. Burlingame, our second speaker, will address this concept. And then, of course, classical nutrition measurements of individual nutrition and health also get back to food and nutrition security. Anthropometry, measuring especially children, and or clinical measures. So without further ado, I would like to begin with our speakers this morning. All of the speakers prefer not to go at great length to introduce their credentials to you. They're all on the McGill website, which is at the bottom of the program you have. Dr. Aashaag from Norway will speak about the human right to food, challenges and possibilities in research and higher education. Dr. Aashaag.
Thank you, Harriet. I'm a professor in public nutrition. I'm not a lawyer, just to put that straight at once, because many people believe I'm a lawyer. Since in particular I'm going to address an important issue that I feel has been under-communicated and not addressed by nutritionists, who is so essential for people. And we heard the presentation yesterday that in the center of things, people's needs and people's dignity should be. If we look back at how this was created and what actually a human right is, it is a way to guide the use of political power, to ask our politicians to be accountable for what they do and suggest. And many people say that this is a Western concept. It's wrong. Because when you see how that was created, together with the United Nations, many different countries were engaged in this, from East to West. So it's not a concept that comes from the West. It's based on ethics that we all share. We have to remember the background when this was created. The atrocities of the Second World War, but also there, and there we have these politicians that actually played a very important role. These were those fighting on the side of Hitler. And then we have others also that seemed during that fight to stick together and that didn't do it afterwards. I could have gone into many, many different things in this because it's a very interesting topic. But just to say that this was the background for why the UN was created and why we have a UN Charter and a Universal Declaration of Human Rights and then the Covenants later on. It was common values, it was ethical standards that we shared. But we have a tendency maybe to forget the economic crisis in the 1930s, which was very important for what's happening. But we need to remember two very important politicians. One, a great politician that was standing forward, and the other more like an activist, but she was nevertheless a great politician. And that's the two Roosevelts, Eleanor and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They were the ones who put this on the agenda and created so many things. Roosevelt was the president. He had the political clout. Eleanor was the activist that pushed him. And look at what he addressed in his inaugural speech. The first one, or what actually stands out, is in 1937, when he said, "What is important is not to add more to those who have more than enough from before, but add to those who have too little." In 1941, he came with the Four Freedom Address. And in 1944, just before he died, he talked about the Economic Bill of Rights. So all these are there, and Eleanor took it further on and was a very great activist. And I must say, when I read about her history today, I really get envious, because she was fantastic. And what was the result of all this? This is a brief sketch of what we are up to. It's just to say that there is a system out there. And if you ask people working in the UN about the UN Charter, they hardly know about it, unfortunately. It should be a guide for their behavior. We have a declaration. The declaration is not ratified. But we have the covenants, civil and political rights, and economic sovereign rights, divided into, but is meant to specify more in detail what is included in the World Declaration of Human Rights. Under here is just examples of conventions, more recent. And the last one on the, what would it be, on the left side here, Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, has just been made and just been established and is ratified by 95 countries. It's one convention that is ratified by most UN countries, and that is the rights of the child. Who can be against the rights of the child? Well, we had some for a moment, but nevertheless. Yesterday also David Nabarro mentioned governance. The UNDP, who is the UN agency running this, talks about democratic governance. Earlier they talked about good governance. And we see these are the principles of human rights and democratic governance. We see they are very similar. At the center of all attention is human dignity. I was happy when David Nabarro said that yesterday. But remember, these are principles to be used to guide the use of political power. That is our governments. It's not NGOs. I just underline that. These are principles that should govern how power is used in the government. Transparency is there, participation, what does that mean? Well, we have elections. Others might have a different way. We have accountability, the principle of accountability, we heard that today as well. We have the responsibility that goes down to the parents, for example, or children. Nobody will question that. We have the transparency and empowerment part, which is very important. So we can say that we have now an international system of juridical norms based on ethical principles where human dignity is central. That is the human rights approach to development. We have placed the juridical part in international human rights law through binding treaties. When you ratify a treaty, it's binding. It's not something that you can do something with if you feel like it. It's binding. You have to report. It's regulate the state's behavior vis-a-vis its own people. One should think that that is obvious, but unfortunately it is not. It introduces obligations of state parties, that is those parties that ratify the covenant, and they try to balance between freedoms and meeting people's needs. The focus both on the result and the outcome, and now they also work much more intensively on the right, on the claim holder, that is the people that have this right, so they can address it if that is needed. It is food, the right to adequate food is firmly embedded in Article 11 of the Covenant that I showed you, but then part of adequate standard of living. It's important to remember that. So when people are talking about standard of living here, it's not by chance. It's there, and it has been there with us for more than 60 years, and for many others have been there longer. We have also tools that can be used. General Commons is a tool developed by experts. It's about 20 now on economic, social, and cultural rights. We have guidelines that can be used for reporting, and that can be used for those countries that ratify to make policies as well. We have now a voluntary guideline on that particular thing. And we have educational learning, and I could add research here as well. Just a little on how it is included, how the general comment on the right to adequate food is specified, which is number 12. It says that the right to adequate food is realized when every man and woman, women and child, alone or in community with others, have physical and economic access at all times to adequate food or means for its procurement. I know that you can read, but for me it was important to sort of reiterate that to what Harriet said in the beginning. You see the similarity with the food security definition, food and nutrition security. It's no accident. The General Comment 12 also highlights the type of obligations that a state has, that has a ratified covenant. Respect, protect, fulfill are the three types of obligations. And the last one, the fulfill, is divided in two, facilitate and provide. And all this is there to be used by us as working in food, nutrition and health. But we don't. Very few actually do it, even though that I must say that the right to food movement has started being very vivid and has grown immensely after 1996 when we got the definition of food security. We see that the other general comments follow the same type of obligations. Respect, protect, fulfill. It's also in health and it's in water. But health and water has added the promote dimension, which is so important. So these issues are very essential for all of us. I will go straight into what does this mean for us? Well, we try to include it in the teaching we do, both at bachelor and master level. We spend a whole day. I've gotten 15 minutes here. So a whole day we spend on going through and try to understand what the right to food means. We have a master's level. The first master from Uganda that did this looked at the whole country as such, at the various actors there. And the second one looked at a poor part in the capital. If we look at the research project, we see that some of the research projects address some of the issues. It's not that it's old stuff in new bottles, in a way. But we try to understand how these contribute to a deeper understanding of what that could be done. And we see here everything from controlled dietary studies to drug abuses in Oslo that could address or that actually have addressed some of the issues here. And they belong to partly the respect thing, protect thing, because what can you protect and what can you respect if you don't know anything about that? So it goes into the evidence base very strongly, and of course the master's programs and other research dimensions address also the facilitate and provide dimension. In research, there have been written two books. We have developed something for the FAO. We have gotten money now to develop a master program together with South Africa and Uganda. And we're going to assign some students to that program now in the fall, in the spring coming. We have three PhDs, one addressing the TRIPS agreement in WTO, one looking at HIV/AIDS challenges in terms of right to adequate food, and a third one, which Harriet knows very well about, it's the indigenous people's right to adequate food. What does it mean? We see that these are typical interdisciplinary dimensions to it. It is law, it is political science, it is nutrition, it is geography. All those dimensions are included. And if we shall understand the complex world around us, there is no way of doing that. I'd just like to end by a man I admire greatly, and that is Kofi Annan. I wonder if we ever had such a good director general ever in history. He said, human rights are what make us human. They are principles by which we create a sacred home for human dignity. So it's a question of choice. What is the world around us? What do we like it to be? Do we want to contribute with money to more money to those who have enough already, or do we want to contribute also to those who have nothing? I would like to think that in capacity development, which is so important, we have a role to play. But then this has to start to be used. Thank you for your attention.
If we have one or two questions now, can you hear me? One or two questions now, but the rest of you can, with other discussion, can address those at the end of the session where Dino will be conducting the discussion. Any questions for Arne at this point?
Yes. I'd like to emphasize that indirectly we are conducting a universal biological experiment. Namely, by providing inadequate nutrition to babies, particularly before birth, we are not only dooming them to difficulties at present, at birth, but early onset disease later on, like cancer, diabetes, etc., which are permanent genetic damage, which is going to be handed down to the following generations. So it isn't going to take very much longer before the world will begin classifying humans into different categories as a result of the different capacities resulting from their genetic makeup. So when we talk about human rights, surely we have to emphasize which right, although they're all useful and important, which right must supersede them all. And surely, I would suggest, if you're talking about human dignity, you have to give human beings, particularly fetuses, a decent chance at survival as well as their progenitors. So how can we tailor human rights work on these grounds rather than simply on legalistic grounds?
Thank you.
Should I respond?
Briefly, if you can. Otherwise,
it's a big question, but I can address it very briefly. To say that what we do in human rights in the various settings will be different and our emphasis will be different. But we cannot do something that is harming somebody else. So what you are describing is something that I've been giving a lot of thought to. Since much of this research originated in Norway, actually, despite it's called the Barker hypothesis. So I agree with you. We have to consider this very carefully, but then nutritionists must get involved together with lawyers, together with political scientists and others in human rights work. This is a very good example where this is absolutely necessary.
Thank you. Thanks very much.